But now Bill Resnick leads off today's program, talking with John Q. James, retired chief toxicologist for NASA and currently a medical safety expert focused on revealing medical errors and what needs to be done to prevent them.
John T. James, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill.
John T. James, before he retired, he was the chief toxicologist for NASA. He's got a lot of really interesting stories about that. Near the end of that service and continuing in life, he became a medical patient health and safety expert, specializing in medical errors. He founded the organization Patient Safety America, and he writes in its monthly newsletter. He's also written a lot, including a book. The title is A Sea of Broken Hearts, Patient Rights in a Dangerous Profit-Driven Healthcare System. He's a critique of healthcare, the fundamentals of the system. John James, tell us why and how you started as a toxicologist and then became an expert on medical errors.
Well, I became a toxicologist kind of by default. I found myself with a PhD in pathology and no real opportunities except endless postdocs. And I found an opportunity to become a toxicologist and work for the Army for a while, and I did that. Got board certified in toxicology and eventually drifted over to NASA, where I worked on air quality throughout my 25-year career and also a little while on water quality in spacecraft. There's some interesting challenges there. And I retired in 2014 to give more time to Patient Safety America.
And how did you get into Patient Safety America? What were the precipitating causes?
In 2002, my son, who was then a student at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, collapsed while running. He was an avid, one would say perhaps a fanatical runner, and was taken to a hospital there. He was evaluated for 5 days in the two hospitals in Waco, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong. They sent him home, and 2.5 weeks later, he died while running. And so I started looking at his medical record and thinking through what had happened. And I was there through most of the time. And I found that they committed at least 3 catastrophic errors. One was they had not followed a guideline for potassium replacement for people with low potassium and heart arrhythmias. He had 3 arrhythmias and quite low potassium. So they overlooked that. They failed to make a diagnosis of long QT syndrome, which had been around since 1980s. And these are all published in major medical journals. And then, in the end, knowing that they hadn't figured out what was wrong, they knew he shouldn't return to running. But they did not tell him not to return to running. So, in fact, he went back to running after he recovered from his invasive tests. And, as I said, he basically died while running. So that's a huge communication error. So in some ways, my son's care is a sort of poster child for how to do medical errors, if you will. So I realized that his care was not that unusual, that many people die of medical errors. And I discovered the IOM report in 2000, To Errors Human, estimating that up to about 98,000 people die from medical errors in hospitals each year. But that was based on data from 1984, which means even then it was old data. So anyway, I started Patient Safety America and with the hope of educating people that they need to be careful about where and how they get health care.
And you also took all of your data, the more recent data, and very carefully analyzed it. And what you found was much, much more deaths and preventable harm in hospitals than any of the other researchers, and now people are beginning to recognize the value of your research. Tell us about the Harvard study estimated 100,000 deaths a year, preventable deaths in hospitals. So did the IOM study. Yours was way beyond that. Tell us about why.
Yeah, I don't want anybody to think that the number of deaths actually went up. Between about 2000 when the IOM study was published and 2013 when my study was published, what had happened is in the interim was that the Institute for Healthcare Improvement developed a tool called the Global Trigger Tool. And it in various forms is designed to detect things in medical records that suggest that a medical error or a preventable adverse event, if you will, has occurred. And there were 4 studies that had used that method by 2010 or so to discern the number of adverse events and the portion of those that were preventable. And no one was doing anything with that information. So as a mere patient activist at that time, I decided I would. So I combined the results of those four studies and expanded it to the nation as a whole. And then I asked myself, what does the global trigger tool miss? And I compensated for that. And it misses errors of omission often. For example, it doesn't know medical guidelines, so it can't say, hey, you guys should have given this medication to this person, but you didn't. In my son's case, it was they should have given him potassium replacement, and they didn't. But that wouldn't have counted as a medical error because the global trigger tool would not have found it.
Because their algorithms did not include that.
That's right. And it's very hard to encompass errors of omission. That is much more challenging than errors of commission, that is doing the wrong thing
right,
or doing the right thing wrong. So the other thing I compensated for is what is missing in medical records. And it's well known that a lot of things that have to do with harm to patient don't end up getting in medical records.
Oh, no.
And I won't elaborate on that, but, you know, that's human nature. So anyway, I came up with 440,000. And the clear thing here I want to make is that's important is those deaths don't always occur in hospitals. Something is done wrong in the hospital that significantly shortens the person's life. It may have consequences weeks or years down the road. But in the end, their life is shortened because something was not done right in the hospital.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to John T. James, a patient safety advocate, a researcher in preventable harm in medical care and what can be done about it. We've been talking about the way he got into it through because of the death of a son, which he then began investigating. He was, by that time, a very careful scientist working for NASA in toxicology. But he was able to both access those records and study them and study the whole area of medical deaths and harm. And his work now as a, quote, non-expert is highly valued in the field. John, let's talk about the solutions. You've written that, I found the, I think it was an op-ed by you, some piece of material that you wrote. The Affordable Care Act, you're talking about Obamacare, addressed some patient safety concerns without changing the fundamental culture that permits errors to continue. And that's probably true of many, many, many of the activities, that is the patient safety activities that now hospitals and doctors are undertaking. I think they've been doing a lot, actually, especially around the hospital caused infections and things like that. There's a lot of action by these hospitals and by the accrediting authorities and hospitals. They have all of these mechanisms for dealing with mistakes, and they have hospital meetings, I mean meetings of the various doctors involved, but those are all very private and they can't even be accessed by lawyers because they're all privileged. These are privileged meetings. But they're doing a great deal to try and lessen, reduce the number of errors. But they're not moving towards, those things are not directed at changing at what you called the fundamental culture that permits errors to continue. Why don't you talk about a lot of those solutions, including some of the solutions that you recommend, but that don't go to the fundamental culture, and then we can talk about changing the fundamental culture. But let's talk about those other solutions first, like with the Affordable Care Act and so many other things that they're doing.
Some of the solutions that are coming along, and they weren't all necessarily driven by the Affordable Care Act.
No, I know that. Yeah,
but there is provision within that act. I think it's called the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute. It was kind of a brainchild of the Affordable Care Act. And the idea was to center on the patient and do research that would make care safer. And so what has happened is There's been really good research done, and there's been islands of excellence created at certain institutes that are really top tier and top notch. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's all spread to the other hospitals or even to outpatient surgical centers and so on. They're not so well regulated as hospitals tend to be. And so you struggle to see where, on a general basis, these changes. Let's say something like checklists. Now, I think it was Peter Ponovos that was a proponent of that and some others. You know, those are good. If you're going to do surgery, you make sure you do a timeout and you go through the steps and you get it done right. But the trouble with even checklists is at some point it kind of becomes routine. And people just, human nature takes them, you just kind of zoom through the checklist to get it done. And you're not really in there when it comes to making sure each step is done right. And then you get mistakes, even with checklists. They're not necessarily the answer to everything. And as you mentioned, there's certainly been improvement in hospital-acquired infections. I think the CDC has documented that. They've dropped about 25% since the early 2000s. And that's good news. And there's been a lot of improvements there. And, of course, the idea that these things have to be reported also makes more attention put on this from hospitals. Now, as to general solutions, that is global fundamental solutions, what I would really like to see, and it goes back to the title of my book, is some really genuine patient rights that patients have when they're hospitalized or going to a surgical center or anything else. They need to have rights that help them make a good decision about their care, and they have rights after their care if something has gone wrong. They should be allowed to be involved in figuring out what went wrong and why. Root cause analysis, if you will. Right now, there's peer review in hospitals, but that is not done very well. A few articles published by doctors have said that. I don't personally know that. I've never been involved in one. But there's flaws there. And you can expect there to be. Am I going to look at one of my friends in the hospital and say, you killed this person because you made a mistake? That is going to be very hard to do. And, of course, there's always a tendency to blame the system rather than the individuals. And often the system is to blame. But often individuals should step up and acknowledge that they've made mistakes as well.
Yeah, it seems to me, in terms of the fundamentals of the system, again, your book, A Sea of Broken Hearts, Patient Rights in a Dangerous Profit-Driven Healthcare System, I mean, that goes at the system. What do you mean by why is a profit-driven healthcare system so dangerous?
Okay, so, I mean, there is a group of people in the country that believe that the capitalist model will fix just about anything. And I'm okay with the capitalist model as long as there's full transparency, which there certainly is not in healthcare. So a capitalist model is not working. But you have a lot of hospitals that the bottom line is much more important than patient safety, and they have their risk management people that keep a lot of things quiet about what's going on in the hospital. And so every once in a while you see these little bursts of, hey, a whole bunch of people got infections from these scopes that they've been using because they can't clean them right. But in the meantime, the hospital kind of knew this was going on but didn't do anything. So you get things like a local hospital here was shut down, a major center, because a lot of deaths were occurring when they did heart transplants, more than the norm. And it turns out there was a lot of kind of ugly politics going on in that hospital, and it was to the detriment of people that had gotten heart transplants. So there's not transparency. We really have to build the healthcare system around something other than how much money it can make. And until we recognize that and do it, I think we're going to be burdened with a hugely overpriced healthcare system. About 19% of our gross domestic product goes to healthcare, much higher than any other developed country.
Where and people live a whole lot longer.
Yes, Bill, you're right. They live a lot longer. In fact, our life expectancy is actually ticking downward.
Yeah. A lot of it is, of course, is suicide and opioid abuse.
I think a lot of it is the opioid abuse. A good portion would be that. And there's another, you know, money-driven. You know, it's all about how much money you can make pushing opioids.
Yeah.
Legally or illegally.
It's really scandalous what they're doing. I mean, it's an enormous scandal at the top of this society, the pharmaceutical industry and opioids. They are murdering people, I mean, in effect. Yeah.
I have two good friends who lost adult children to accidental opioid overdoses.
Yeah.
And it's tragic.
Yeah, we can't go into that. But clearly the profit system, the way it works in the United States, causes a huge amount of suffering and death. This is KBOO Radio, Bill Resnick, talking to John T. James, who has become a leading expert in quotes on medical errors and how they occur and what has to be done. John James, I guess one final issue. I find that, maybe more than one, my sense is in chronic disease care, which is really mostly probably majority of hospital effort and time spent in hospitals and patient care and diagnosis and therapeutics is done for chronic diseases, right? Diabetes, heart disease, various other. Asthma, it goes on, and people are constantly reappearing in hospitals and being resuscitated or having amputations or whatever goes on in this chronic disease. New devices. A change in the way chronic diseases are handled towards far more effort to help people live lives so that the disease does not recur, especially in diabetes, where if you're really careful and diligent and your family supports you and your doctors support you, you can live a pretty normal life for a very long time with the disease. And it seems to me that instead of just having doctors doing procedures on people as the peak of the system, you would really have a very different system where this sort of team of people who know about health and how to keep healthy and also do some procedures where they meet and where it's the team that sort of plans the healthcare program and also helps. And it's the team members, many social workers, medical social workers they're called, can go and talk to the family and the patient himself or herself and sort of plan a regimen of life, including eating, especially in diabetes and exercise, that keep the person really healthy for a long time. And that's going to work much better than the system we have now. But the doctors sort of bridle at that. They want to be the kings of the hill. And with their skills, whatever it is, in amputating or in trying to treat eye diseases that are caused by diabetes or kidney diseases caused by diabetes, they're into this kinds of treatment, and they want to be the sort of the heads of the team. But in real teaming, it may well be nurses and social workers who have much more say in it, and the doctors would, in fact, lose their controlling power. Is that the kind of solution? And because chronic diseases are so expensive and so many people suffer, it seems to me that's a fundamental reform that would help stamp out medical errors as well.
I think it would certainly be a move in the right direction. And honestly, Bill, it goes back to my appeal for patient rights. If you go to your primary care doctor and you've got diabetes and they don't tell you the options other than taking a medication or another medication or another medication, then they're not doing their job. And you have a right to know, if in my world, you have a right to know what your options are. And one of the options, as you mentioned, should be an integrated approach to managing your illness so that you aren't such a burden on the system. But that's not the way it works. There's not money made by the medical care system itself that way. Medical systems make money fixing what's broken in you, not preventing them from getting broken. And that's a fundamental problem. But with the proper patient rights, a lot of things could be fixed.
John T. James, do you want to have the last word, and then I'll just we'll say thank you to you?
Well, if you allow me that, because what we didn't get to was Medicare and how to fix that. Medicare is okay the way it is, but it needs to quit paying for procedures that are unnecessary, and it needs to get out of politics. We have got to get American care out of politics. There needs to be a Medicare system for all that is run by the people directly and that Congress does not have direct control over. We have representatives elected from different areas of the country to advocate for the people in that area. You could do it by each state, and patients would have rights in these systems, and it would work for everyone. So we got a long ways to go to fix it, but I thank you and I thank your listeners for hearing some of the ideas about what needs to be fixed.
John T. James, your Patient Safety America is on the web. Monthly newsletter comes. It's very informative. I read it maybe half the time, I have to admit, but I do read it. It's very valuable. It's only 4 pages, right? You know, we're deluged with information, but it's really good. Thanks a lot for your work, and keep it up.
Well, thank you, Bill.
That was Humble Pie's Doctor Doctor. I don't need no doctor may be overstating things a bit, but we must be aware when dealing with the medical establishment, we are potentially confronting dangerous consequences that have nothing to do with our actual malady.